Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another podcast from the Warner Archive Collection. It is always special when someone who has participated in our movies shares time with us here on a podcast and talk about the films that they've made and the films that we're releasing. But today is extra special because we get to speak to the star of these films. The films are, of course, Hold On and Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter. And the star of the films is Peter Noon, the lead singer, the Herman, if you will, from Herman's Hermits. And it is my great pleasure as a longtime fan of Herman's Hermits and Mr. Noon to speak with him on the phone today as part of our Warner Archive Collection podcast. So let me say, I would say good afternoon to you since you're speaking to us from the East Coast today.
Yeah, I'm actually in Florida. I'm going to play at Disney, Epcot in Disney World tonight.
Oh, that's great. I do know that you're touring all over the country, all over the world, singing the songs that everybody loves that you've been sharing with us for so long. I do want to call out to anyone who's a fan to follow Mr. Noon anytime he is in your area because he's performing all the time and people love those songs. And that's why we've had such a great response to the fact that we've released these movies on DVD for the first time. And Hold On has never been on home video before at all. I was trying to get all these films out and now we've done it because When the Boys Meet the Girls will be coming out at the beginning of July. How did it begin with Herman's Hermits coming to Hollywood? And did it start with When the Boys Meet the Girls?
Yeah, you know what happened was with MGM, our agent said that MGM wanted us to make an appearance in a film. And we said, who's in the film? And they said Connie Francis, who was also an MGM artist, and Louis Armstrong, who I wanted to meet. And we instantly agreed to do the picture. I don't think we even asked how much money we were getting paid. We just wanted to do the picture and meet Louis Armstrong and, and all the people who were in it, and Sam the Sham. And we signed up for the picture, and when we got to, it was in Culver City at the MGM Studios, the driver said that there were more fans at the gate than Elvis Presley had had when he'd made a movie there. We figured we were now in the big time, and you know, it was quite an extraordinary experience, and we sang... I think Liberace, when we got there, was singing Aruba Liberace.
That's correct, which he wrote for that movie.
So I said, well, wait a second, that isn't a George Gershwin song. He told us we had to do a George Gershwin song. And they said, well, you know, he wrote his own song. So I said, okay, we want to do one of our songs. So we got two songs in the movie. We got Listen People and Biding My Time, which is a great George Gershwin song. So we ended up with two songs because we didn't know that you could write one. We thought we were doing a remake of
Girl Crazy.
Girl Crazy, yeah, which was all Gershwin songs. So anyway, it was a good experience. We enjoyed it. We had a couple of days. I think they had go-go dancers in Listen People, which was a bit of a ballad, so that was kind of tough to figure out. It was the beginning of that. So it was a wonderful period, you know, because the people at MGM had no idea what we did and who we were, and you know, the fact that I was already an actor was kind of an asset, but none of the Hermits were actors, so they were just sort of like stranded.
And they built when Hold On. I mean, the Hold On is basically your movie, and your bandmates are in the movie performing with you, but the plot is all about you. And they build you under your own real name. Was that part of kind of your request, or you know, because it established you as your own artist? That was my perception as a fan and as a viewer and as a kid.
Well, yeah, and Hold On. Yeah, well, I was a kid too.
I know.
So by the time we got to Hold On, they had we'd heard. We were all excited because they said they'd got us the director of the Three Stooges. So we were very excited. I said, "That's the Lubin," because we thought, "Well, great, we'll get to do all this weird, you know, knocking each other on the head and stuff, which we can do very well." And then we got there, and the first thing that Arthur Lubin did was take us on the set to introduce us to Mr. Ed.
I was going to ask about that. That's right, because Arthur Lubin directed all the Mr. Ed TV shows.
Yeah, so we went and met Mr. Ed, which we said, well, this is not going exactly as planned. We thought we were going to, like, be doing this comedy thing, but now we were the talking horse.
Right.
And Arthur Lubin was this total, he was adorable, he was a gentleman. And, you know, Herman's Hermits were all gents, so, you know, we appreciated when other people had good manners and everything. He was a very well-educated, older guy, and he let us basically rewrite the script. They had all these awful songs for us. There was a song called There's No Place Like Space, and we didn't want to record it because it's like a mixture of There's No Business Like Show Business and There's No Place Like Space. You can get the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We refused to record it, and Mickey Most flew over. Mickey Most, not Mickey Mouse, our record producer. He flew over from England, and we started looking for other songs. So we got Hold On and A Must to Avoid, written by P.F. Sloan, who'd written The Eve of Destruction.
Right.
He said, well, you know, we need Herman Hermit's pop songs. So we suddenly we had Carger and Wayne writing all those great songs they wrote for us, but the ones we didn't like, we didn't record. And then in that movie, it was basically this, every movie had the same plot, I think, was you'd fall in, you were this English band, and you'd come to America, and you'd fall in love with some girl.
Right.
So in that movie, it was Shelley Fabre, and I did fall in love with her, but she was married.
Oh, dear. I was going to ask you if you had, did you see her on television when you were in England? Did they have the Donna Reed show over there?
No, they didn't, but I saw her walk into the first shooting, and I was in love.
That was enough. Well, she's a beautiful, she's still a very beautiful lady.
And she was a great person, and she was married to Lou Adler, who was like one of the great record producers of the time. So, you know, we would hang out. We had a house up at Benedict Canyon, the band. We rented, you know, it was called the Beatles house because the Beatles had rented it, but it was really Cary Grant's house.
Ah.
You know, we invited Lou and her up there, and every night we'd all had dinner together, and it was just a really wonderful time because we didn't know that every day we would be starting at 6 a.m. You know, that wasn't, 6 a.m. was usually bedtime, when we'd start bedtime, and now suddenly we had to switch our whole lives around and eat dinner and stuff like that. It was quite an extraordinary experience, and everybody on the set, you know, it was like Dennis the Menace's father.
All the questions I was going to ask you, you see, you're answering them without me having to ask them, which is the ultimate.
You know, that's the way I work. In the airport scene, one of the policemen was a huge star in England, and he was now an extra, and he was in an English TV show called Last of the Mohicans, and he was one of the characters in Last of the Mohicans, and we were in shock. We all got pictures taken with him, and he's got his autograph, and he was by now an extra, but in England the show was still running in prime time. You know, it was like a huge hit in England, Last of the Mohicans. And so everybody was really charming to us. You know, the Dennis the Menace Anderson.
Herb Anderson
was just delightful. You know, I think he was used to working with kids because I guess Dennis had been a kid in that TV series that he was in. So we were just about 3 or 4 years older than us, and he knew how to deal with us. Everybody was just great with us. Everybody was just great.
And you were 17 years old at the time?
I think I probably made 17 by then.
Yeah.
I mean, it just was one of those magical parts of that British invasion where there were, you know, I was the youngest one by a long way, and then I think Stevie Winwood was the same age of me. He was in there was nobody, everybody, like the Beatles were all 5 or 6 years older than us.
Of course.
And, you know, we just got on with it, and we had such a fun time on the set because I think it was like the first English band that had ever been exposed to all those Hollywood producers. You know, they'd done Elvis, and they'd done Roy Orbison, maybe, and they'd done all these kind of pop singers. But I don't think they'd ever had, like, a gang English thing. I'm sure that's where eventually, like, the Monkees idea came from that whole, you know, the idea of we were on the set and we were inventing it as we walked along.
Right.
And work through it.
One of the things that I loved, I hadn't seen the film in a very long time until we just remastered it from the original negative, so we're of course going to be sending you copies if they haven't done that already, and the films look and sound marvelous, but I was struck by in Hold On how it's not just a narrative film, but it also gives people a chance to see you folks really performing. I know you pre-recorded your numbers, but it really feels like you're performing live. It gives a sense of what you were like. Do you agree that it's a pretty good capsule of your performance style of the era?
Well, it was the same as playing live because, you know, what we did, we didn't have any experience other than playing live. So when we played it on the set, I mean, we went and recorded them. I think, listen, one of the songs was recorded in like that, you know, where they make coconut shells, horseshoes, what's that called? The Foley room.
That's correct.
You know, we took the amps into the Foley room and made a record, you know, because we were just, it was all stream of consciousness. You know, it was all, oh, we need another song, let's go and record it. And I remember that guy, the guy who was famous in England, was called Ray Kellogg.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a huge star in England, and he played just a detective. And I remember we enjoyed Bernard Fox, who was another fellow Englishman. I wonder if he's still around. He played our manager. He had all the best comedy lines in it.
He is terrific in the movie, and audiences know him from playing Dr. Bombay in the Bewitched television series with Elizabeth Montgomery. And I think he was also in Munster Go Home. Now, I have to ask you about the name. Did you come up with the name Herman for Herman's Hermits, or did someone else come up with that?
The name Herman's Hermits came from, we were called Pete Novak and the Heartbeats, and we were desperate for a new name, but we were kind of pretty famous as Pete Novak and the Heartbeats, so we were looking for names, and we used to rehearse in this old pub in Manchester, you know, because they were always closed in those days. They opened at 5:30 and they closed at 10 o'clock, you know, because they just didn't want people sitting in pubs all day. So we used to get to rehearse there when it was closed. It was like after school from 4 till 5:30, we could rehearse in this pub. And the guy who owned the pub, and sadly I don't remember his name, he said, we were sitting with him and we were going to call ourselves something in the Harmonies. And he goes, well, and we used to wear these, I wore these horn-rimmed glasses because we used to do an impersonation of Buddy Holly. And I had these Buddy Holly glasses on, and he said to me, Who do you think you are? And I says, well, I'm trying to look like Buddy Holly. He says, you don't look like Buddy Holly. You look like Sherman from the Bullwinkle Show.
Oh, my goodness. The reason why I asked that is when I was a little kid, I was about 5 or 6 years old, I had a little, it was like a Herman's Hermits collectible card, and on the back, it said that the name was adapted from the Sherman character on Rocky and Bullwinkle, and I was going to ask you if that was accurate. So again, you've answered before I got to ask it.
So we said, okay, so, I think he said Herman from the Bullwinkle.
Uh-huh.
And he says, and call yourself Herman and the Bloody Hermits.
Well, so the name stuck, and it stuck well. One of the things we did is we put together a lot of the films where I explained to all my colleagues here that MGM Records wanted to make their best-selling record artists, and you were the number one for them, into movie performers, and that's what they had done with Connie Francis, and they did that with you. And the third film, Mrs. Brown, that was, I would assume, a different kind of setup because they shot it in the UK, correct?
Yeah, it was a totally different thing. What happened was the MGM ones that were made in Hollywood were really good fun and silly, and you know, they were like those Elvis Presley movies.
Exactly.
Very little plot, but they made you look good. And then they went to England, and we decided that Trevor Peacock had written this song called Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, so he was now a script writer. And we basically loaded up with friends.
Ah.
Which is not really the right way to make a great motion picture. You know, what you want to do is get the most talented people around, and they were all in Hollywood. So Alan Klein became a producer. He was an accountant, and his friend from school became the director. And it all exploded from there, really. And we sort of, as in the first two movies, we would make it up as we went along.
Right.
You know, we would basically write this. They would give us ideas for the script, but we would change all the words. Not the hermits so much as, I mean, there's one in Hold On, one of the hermits says, like, in almost as if it's a comedy moment, he goes, this is a fun trip. Reading the line but not knowing what it means.
Right.
This is a fun trip. You know, but I would play it. I mean, I thought that I believed I was the character. You know, I'd probably read one Stanislavski book and believed that I understood exactly what was going on and that I was actually now an actor because, look, they were giving us another movie. The whole thing was just a blast. I mean, in England, what happened, though, during the movie, for the first time in our lives, it took a long time, actually, and we were off the road and we couldn't, you know, it wasn't like being in Hollywood and running around until 5 o'clock and having a shower and going to work. In England, we stayed in this hotel in Shepperton where all the famous people had always stayed, you know. Everybody always stayed in the same hotel, and it was like a thing. And they fed us. And every night we would get back from shooting, and there would be a meal on the table, like meal and wines and things. And we'd never eaten meals before, you know. you can actually watch Herman's Hermits go from like 110 pounds to 130 pounds.
Now, I have to ask you, Stanley Holloway, how did he become part of Mrs. Brown, and did you enjoy working with him? Because he was quite a legend.
He was the greatest. He was a legend for me. Everything about it was just magical for us. I mean, they got Stanley Holloway, and he was nice to us.
That was my point, because he's a, you know, one of the great stars of the British theater. I think that a lot of the people listening to this here know, if they know Stanley Holloway, they know him from the film of My Fair Lady, but they don't know that he was, you know, Fagin and Oliver in the UK and so forth. So this is a legend of the UK West End stage.
I didn't know he was in Fagin, but yes. I think he was great. And he was just brilliant. he made it all seem simple. He even sang a song with us. You know, we got lemon and lime, a tenner a time, a five, four, a couple of bob. And he danced and everything, and we had to dance with him. It was like a magical experience because we were just kids. We were just going with the flow. We had no idea what was going on.
That was exactly what I wanted to know, because the sensibility of that film is, it feels like it's, you know, light years away from what was done in Hollywood.
Yeah, they were trying to make us a bit different. You know, they were trying to make it a bit different, is what can I say? Yeah, they wanted everybody to be themselves. I mean, the Trevor Peacock, when he wrote the script, and they had this guy, Norman Thaddeus Bain, which must have been, couldn't have possibly been his real name. At 1-10, it was loaded up with friends because Norman Thaddeus Bain was the girl in the movie. You know what I mean?
Yes.
She played, I can't think, the big tall girl. I guess her name was Sarah Caldwell, but she was Thaddeus' wife. And they tried to make us in the movie as ourselves. They played Peter Noon as if he was Herman, you know, with living with my grandmother, which I did.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mr. Brown played this, you know, Stanley Holloway played like this posh southern guy that was, and his wife, Mona Washburn, another huge talent.
Another great actress, yes.
Yeah, great actress. Played a thing, and of course, everybody in England already knew, Lance Percival and Marjorie Rhodes. They were all famous, famous people. And it just all worked out to, you know, apart from the fact that we all, like, exploded weight-wise for the movie, it was a good experience. You know, we all stayed in the same hotel every night, and everybody was, it was probably like that. We were making a real movie. They shot things to the soundtrack. We made the soundtrack in a recording studio, and then we, you know, like, there's a kind of, I think the best scene in Mrs. Brown Got a Lovely Daughter is the one which has There's a Kind of Hush as the theme. And it was shot as, like an early video.
Exactly.
Like an MTV video.
I mean, I noticed that in watching it, because it was only made 2 years after Hold On, and yet it feels like it was made 10 years later because of the changes that were going on in the world at the time, too. At least that was my view of it, because, you know, things had gotten a lot more realistic because of the anti-war movement and students protesting, and the whole world was changing at that time with rapid movement. And I think it's reflected in the difference between the two films. At least that was my perception.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the world had changed quite a bit. Remember, however you perceive it, 1965 musical was like Panglossian,
right,
compared to 1967.
Exactly.
The naive idea that the world was all going terribly well was sort of flushed away. People, you know, it's like, remember there was a war in Vietnam, and everybody goes, you know, the 60s, the swinging 60s. Well, it was a hideous time for English people. They had a government that wasn't working, that managed to stay there. They were taxing everybody like huge. Entertainers got taxed more than anybody because we were all just really flop. We weren't like industrial. Even though we probably brought in more money to the UK than any of all the other businesses that were running, probably BP was the only thing that brought in more money than music. And the idea that it had changed it significantly. You know, I mean, if you think of the charts already, by 1967, all those British invasion bands were kind of gone. The Beatles were gone. You know, they weren't touring. The Stones had been arrested. You know, it was different. It was all different. It wasn't all these cheeky chappies over from England.
Right. And that was my memory of it at the time as a very young person. But I was very aware of what was going on. And I remember watching, anytime you folks would be on the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, I would make my parents let me stay up so I could see and so forth. I mean, it was just, so I was rabidly looking forward to Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter when it finally came to the theaters. But there were no other movies like that by 1968. You guys were the only ones that got another chance to make another movie.
I think what happened was that we were ahead of it as well. They stopped making movies like that before we made ours. They stopped it. It all went away. You know, and you notice what is significant is that most people who make a movie like that end up not having a recording career.
Right.
MGM were not aware of that, you know, even though they were both. They had a label and a thing. They weren't aware that, like, historically, and especially since then, if you've got like a big, huge chart thing, Madonna, you're in the charts every week with a different song, so you decide you're going to make, Evita.
Right.
Never had another hit.
Or Shanghai Surprise.
Yeah, it was Evita that stopped. after having hits. And then the other girl who was married to Bobby Brown, what was her name?
Whitney Houston.
Yeah, Whitney Houston makes The Bodyguard, big number one picture, never has another hit record.
It's absolutely true.
Constantly happens, and you go, you know, uh-oh, here comes competition. Don't worry, they're going to make a movie soon.
Well, I like the fact that Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter has such a disparate feel from the other two pictures, and that's why we wanted to make sure we could bring them all out. And the interesting thing is, when we talked to Connie Francis, and by the way, when people are listening to this podcast, that's the first, we even announced that When the Boys Meet the Girls is coming out at the beginning of July, so you've heard it here first, folks. The interesting thing about it is Connie Francis was kind of tricked into making that movie, and just as they told you, well, you're going to be singing Gershwin, right? So with her, they said, you're remaking Girl Crazy, and you're playing the Judy Garland part, and Harve Presnell is going to play the Mickey Rooney part. But they didn't tell her that, you know, Sam the Sham would be in the movie and so forth and so on. So she said, well, if Sam the Sham is going to be in the movie, I want Liberace and I want Louis Armstrong and I want Herman's Hermits in there too. And that's what she said in an interview she did with us not too long ago. And she said her favorite part about the movie, even though I don't think you had any scenes with her, did you?
I don't think I did. I know I've got loads of photographs with her.
Yeah, I don't recall. I think your characters don't have any scenes together. But I love the fact that I thought it was very interesting. You're telling me that you brought Listen People to the movie. And I wondered what that if you had said, hey, I want to sing a Gershwin song, and you recorded Biding My Time, which I thought was really great because you did it in your own style. It sounds authentically like a Herman's Hermits song. And I wondered if audiences, you know, at the time knew, hey, that's not a new song. That's actually 35 years old and written for Girl Crazy in 1930.
So it was easy for me because I did know the song.
Right.
We didn't actually do it in our set, but it wasn't a big stretch for us to do it. It was a beautiful song. We could have done any of those, like every song in that movie. The only song that I didn't think was worthy of Aruba Liberace.
Yes.
It's not a memorable hit.
No, it certainly isn't. But I must also mention that I had the great pleasure of seeing you when you were on Broadway, when you were in the Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, that was great. I enjoyed that. I had great fun. Me and Jim Belushi, we had a great time. I was in it for about 3 years. I did the American tour, I did Broadway, I did the London, the West End version, and then I went to New Zealand and did it for a few months.
Yeah,
and I loved it.
I was living in New York at the time, and I had enjoyed the show once, but I didn't think I'd go back to see it again. But when I heard that you were in it, I went back, and I thought it was even better than it ever was before, and the audiences were going nuts because they had such a great time because they had, you know, a lot of them had been longtime fans of yours, and your fans seem to follow you wherever you go, that you keep sharing your music and all the songs that are in the movies that we now have on DVD, but also the other songs that aren't in the movies. Like, I remember you recorded Silhouettes, which was a great song, and Into Something Good, all the wonderful songs that people know you so well for. I've seen all the clips on YouTube that everywhere you're going all around the world sharing your music with audiences now, and generations that grew up are now sharing your music with their kids, and it just keeps going on and on and on. So we're
I get to sing my songs a lot. I mean, I get to sing all my songs 3 times today in different parts of the world in one day. You know, I go to Epcot and I walk through France and Japan to the American stage. I don't know why Herman's Hermits British Invasion Band is on the American stage, but that's where we're playing. Everybody knows the songs, and grandparents bring their children who bring their children, and it's, you know, it's still good, clean fun.
It sure is, and I when I saw the footage of you, I was like, you know, Peter is so magnificent that he's singing everything in the same key he sang it in when he originally recorded them, and with the same wonderful voice.
Yeah, and you just trying hard to keep it like that.
Well, I salute you. I thank you so much for spending the time talking with us today. It's been a great honor and a great privilege, and I hope we get a chance to meet or talk again soon, as we're going to let the world know that Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter and Hold On are available now when you go to our website, which is waterarchive.com, and in July we'll be releasing the Gershwin Musical Spectacular starring Mr. Peter Noon and Herman's Hermits, When the Boys Meet the Girls. So thank you so much for spending time with us.
Bye, thank you.
We really want to thank Peter Noon for taking the time to join us today for this Warner Archive Collection podcast, and remind you that Hold On and Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter are now available on DVD or electronic download for the very first time by going to the WarnerArchive.com website, where we have over 950 motion pictures and television programs available for the first time, brought to you that you can order directly from our website, including, hold on, and Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, and you heard it here first, folks, When the Boys Meet the Girls, starring Connie Francis and Liberace and Mr. Peter Noon, Herman of Herman's Hermits, and Harv Presnell and Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs and Louis Armstrong. All those people are in this wacky, wild reworking of the Gershwin musical Girl Crazy. And When the Boys Meet the Girls is one of several films we'll be releasing in July that star the one and only Miss Connie Francis, the MGM Records recording artist who, until the arrival of Madonna, was the largest-selling female recording artist in history. And we're going to be bringing out all of her MGM films on DVD for the first time in July, so it's a Warner Archive Collection podcast scoop. Thank you for joining us today. We have many more podcasts set up for you with interviews with some of the performers from our films, as well as radio presentations of our films from the golden era. So always look for the next Warner Archive Collection podcast, and we hope you'll join us again. Please check out our website, WarnerArchive.com, where the greatest entertainment ever made in Hollywood history is awaiting you now. Have a great day.